And we are back on the Big Wake Up Call, and time for my next guest. He is one of the best-selling authors in the world, and his newest, City on Fire, is available where books are sold. We are going to chat with Don Winslow. Don, good morning, and thanks for calling in today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
How are things going where you are? What's going on today?
You know, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm in a hotel, and I'm kind of doing this, and then I'll finish up my day in Scottsdale, Arizona. At a bookstore, meeting with readers and things. So it's a busy day.
So what do we have here in City on Fire?
The book follows, well, first, it's the first of a trilogy. And
okay.
The three books follow a guy named Danny Ryan. And in this first book, we meet him as a longshoreman in Providence, Rhode Island. He marries into the Irish mob and ends up dragged into a war between the Irish and the Italians for control of the New England crime world.
Is he aware that he's marrying into the mob?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, look, in Rhode Island, everybody knows everybody. You know, I've always said that the motto of Rhode Island should be, I know a guy.
Okay.
So, he's very aware of it. You know, it's a very small world and a very small state. And so he knows what he's getting into, definitely.
Now, was this always intended to be a trilogy, or do you start writing and like, oh, man, I know where I can go with this, and you're going to set it up for three volumes?
You know, yeah, I always thought of this as a trilogy. When I first had this idea, I had the idea about what the arc of Danny's life was going to be, and it fell very nicely into three parts, you know, all of which end with kind of what's next for the guy. So, you know, we meet him in New England, but in book two, he's in Hollywood, and in book three, he's in Las Vegas. And by the way, all three books have been written. So, yeah, I always plan this for three books.
Okay, so you've already written the third one, you've turned those all in, and then going back to talk about volume one, do you kind of have to refamiliarize yourself with the book to do a tour like this?
I did. You're dead on, man. You know, because I wrote, you know, I finished it several years ago.
Okay.
And so I did have to go back and read and go, oh, what's that character's name? What did I do with this guy? And even in writing the trilogy, you know, I had to go back a little by the time I was at book three to make sure I didn't have some guy, you know, pop up that I'd killed in book one.
I hear that from novelists quite a bit, and I'm just amazed at the productivity because, yeah, we'll be talking about one book. They've already turned their next one in and are halfway through a third. It's just how you guys are able to keep these characters straight.
Yeah, I don't know, man. The schizophrenia helps, I guess, but, you know, people don't realize that, you know, by the time a book comes out, it's gone through a very long process of, you know, copy editing and marketing and production and all of that. And we, because that's what we do, we're professional writers, have moved on, you know, to the next projects.
Now, I've heard this is a reference to a retelling of Virgil's. I think this is kind of a modern day Iliad. Do you run into any copyright issues from, you know, great, 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 great times 1,000 grandchildren?
None of Homer's great, 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 great grandchildren have contacted me so far.
Oh, good.
We'll see. You know, it's that kind of world. But so far, so good.
But that's interesting that there is so much in civilization, in human behavior, in cities, in groups, that you're drawing parallels between 25 BC and gang wars today.
You know, it's amazing. When I started reading the Iliad, for instance, which, you know, of course, tells about the fall of Troy, it begins with an incident involving a woman, i.e. Helen of Troy. I was so struck because it reminded me so much of an incident that happened in real life in New England in the late 1960s in the crime world. And as I started to read more and more of the classics, I saw more and more of the parallels. And the great themes that we deal with in my beloved crime genre, you know, were all done by the Greeks and the Romans. Power, betrayal, loyalty, murder, revenge, forgiveness, love, lust, they're all there.
Have you seen, and maybe this would be great for this trilogy, your books like translated into Greek? Because, boy, wouldn't that be just getting back to those roots?
Well, that's funny you say that. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, I'm very lucky. I think my books are out in 36 languages, including Greek. So that's a fascinating idea. I'll have to look into that because it is out in Greek.
I always wonder if, like, you've said, okay, you'll see an author. Oh, their books have been translated into 45 different languages. If you've ever taken your book, the translation, translate that back into English and see how close they nailed it.
Well, I wish I were that multilingual. You know, I speak English, you know, some Spanish, enough French to annoy people in restaurants, and Swahili is probably my best language.
Really?
I don't know that my book's published in Swahili, but so I don't have the skills to do it. But I have sat with people reading them, you know, at events in foreign languages, and sometimes it disturbs me that they sound better, you know.
Well, there, as you mentioned, you know, French to be dainty, there are just some languages that flow more freely than English. So I would think as a writer, that's kind of gratifying that someone in other countries, other languages, love your book so much that they want to get it the way they can.
Oh, it's really fun. You know, in Germany, for instance, the guy who does my audiobooks and who goes on tour with me is also the voice of James Bond.
Oh.
He dubs James Bond into German for the film, so he's got that great voice, you know. And he sits there and reads my stuff, and I think about James Bond.
That would be a great gig, to be the German James Bond, which is interesting because if there's ever a German in a James Bond film, it's just a guy speaking, you know, English with a very bad German accent.
Isn't that the truth? You know, and one time in Germany, one of the Bond films had just opened, and they opened the theater for us in an afternoon, and about six of us, including Dietmar, this actor, went and watched it. It was so much fun. I was sitting with him, and I'd elbow him, you know, to get him to speak the lines ahead of time. It's really a lot of fun.
And speaking of movies, and you've had several of your projects adapted. I'm reading this particular trilogy is going to be a film. How soon after you have something going are people interested in film rights? I mean, oh, this is a Don Winslow project. We know we have a winner here.
You know what? This book was bought in its manuscript form.
Nice.
And they hadn't even read the other two books because I hadn't written them yet. So it was really nice. On a Friday afternoon, my agent, Shane, called up and said, you going to be home for about 20 minutes? And I said, yeah, I'm packing to leave. But he said, well, you've got a big decision to make in a few minutes, and called up, and Sony just bought the whole trilogy, sort of on faith.
Well, that has to feel pretty good. That'll, you know, feel pretty good going into your weekend if that happens on a Friday.
Yeah, it was nice. You know, we were about to drive cross country, which we do every year, we being my wife and I. So, yeah, that's a nice little bonus, you know.
City on Fire, the first of upcoming trilogy, is available where books are sold. The author, of course, my guest, Don Winslow. And Don, great talking to you, and appreciate you calling in today.
Great talking to you, and thank you for having me.
And welcome back to the Big Wake Up Call. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and time for my next guest, who has written one of the most talked about books of the year, a debut novel, Skandar and the Unicorn Thief. And we're going to visit with A.F. Stedman. And good morning, and thanks for joining me today.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, during the interview, would you like to be referred to as Annabelle, or do you want me to stick with A.F. so we stay on brand?
Annabelle is fine.
Well, how are you then? How are things going where you are?
Yeah, really well, really well. It's not too early for me. It's the afternoon in London, so I'm very well, thank you. Very excited that the book comes out today.
Yeah, I'm reading that you grew up in the Kent countryside, and I think the only two things I know, of course, we know Edward, Duke of Kent, and then from Monty Python, I think Tunbridge Wells is somewhere near Kent, and that's my knowledge.
Yeah, that wasn't so far from me. That was only about an hour from me. So,
well,
yeah.
Great. Totally on the same page. So, briefly, obviously without any spoilers, can you share with us a little bit about the book Skandar and the Unicorn Thief?
Of course. So, Skandar and the Unicorn Thief is set in a world of warrior unicorns, elemental magic, and unlikely heroes. The story follows 13-year-old Skandar Smith, who has always dreamed of becoming a unicorn rider. But when the most powerful unicorn in the world is stolen, Skandar and his friends have to take to the skies and battle bloodthirsty unicorns and a deadly enemy.
See, now I love the idea of seeing unicorns. Of course, we've seen magical uniforms, unicorns all the time. My daughter was just playing with Twilight Sparkle and Rainbow Dash, but having bloodthirsty unicorns, I love that idea. How did you come up with the concept of a bloodthirsty unicorn?
So I had the idea about 8 years ago. This image of a boy riding this unicorn just came into my mind as I was walking home. And I looked at it and I just thought that unicorn doesn't look like it belongs in a fairy tale. It looks like it belongs in a nightmare. And that was the kind of first idea. But I've never really liked fluffy, friendly unicorns. I think I've always been more of a dragon person. Lots of the kind of fluffy merchandise started coming into the shops, I just thought, wouldn't it be interesting to think about unicorns in a different way? And also, I've never trusted that they're friendly because they have the big horn on their heads. It looks very dangerous. And so I thought I'd play with the idea.
Well, how can they be deadly when we have learned by now that friendship is magic?
Well, the interesting thing about Skandar is that in his world, there are wild unicorns, which are terrible, really, really scary monsters. And then there are bonded unicorns. So those unicorns, they bond with a rider, their destined rider. And although they're still ferocious and deadly, and they do like eating kind of like not your average horse kind of food, that bond between them, there is a kind of friendship there, and a deep bond that kind of, it plays with the idea of a horse and a human or with your pet. So it's not, you know, friendship is still magic in Skandar.
I love, and you wrote in the acknowledgments about the cover that the design team was able to reflect the world that lived in your imagination. And just reading you say that, looking at the cover here, it's like, yeah, I totally get a sense of what this could be about. This wasn't just slapped together. Like, this really captures the essence of the book.
Yeah, I was really worried about seeing the cover because I just thought, how are they going to do this? And I'm a very visual writer, and so I see these in my head all the time, and you know, battling and using the elements. And I just thought, how are they going to recreate that? But as soon as I saw the first kind of sketches of it, I just knew that they understood, and they understood that it wasn't kind of the normal sort of unicorn.
Well, let's talk about that, writing visually. And are you, as you're writing this, are you picturing this cinematically as, oh, this is how I would love to see it portrayed? Because now I'm reading about a huge publishing deal, a huge movie deal. That doesn't happen very often for a debut novel.
Yeah, so I think I've always, I wasn't thinking about film when I wrote it at all. When you're writing a book, you just normally just think it's terrible. So I never believed that. But I think I do write very, I play the scenes in my mind. So if I can't see it in my mind, I do struggle to write it because I'm almost describing what I'm seeing. And then I think when Sony read the book, they could also see it too. And that really helped with how they want to kind of visualize the world.
I'm so glad to hear you say that and to continue to hear it from other successful authors and artists that, oh, as I'm writing it, I just think it's terrible because I write songs, some of which have done very well, but every single time I'm writing this, you get in the mindset of, oh, I hate this. I hate everything I've done. And I don't know if there's just something about the creative process that, you know, makes us want to just beat ourselves up.
I think so. There must be. Also, it doesn't get easier because then this is going to be a 5-book series. So with books, I went through exactly the same thing. So yeah, sadly that feeling has stayed, but at least now there are real readers, so that's exciting.
Had you intended in any way for this to be a multiple series? Like, did you stop at a certain point thinking, okay, I'll resolve the story here, but I know there's going to be another adventure coming up?
So I think when I was working with my agent, I really thought this could be a series because I wanted the children in the book to grow up as the series went on. And they have each year of training as unicorn riders, and there's 5 years. So it made sense to me. But I think I think I didn't really imagine that anyone else would want it to be more than one. So it is really good.
Now, a lot of authors, especially novelists I will talk to, they are promoting one book. They have already turned in a second and are writing the third. Is that in any way reflecting where you're at?
Yes, it absolutely is. Second book is in edits. Third book is starting to be written. And here I am promoting the first one. Also, I've recently read the first draft of the film script. So that's also something I'm doing at the moment.
So then do you have to do, a little bit of personal prep for these media tours to make sure, oh yeah, this happens in the book and that happens in the screenplay? Although you lived with this first book for so long, I think you would be, just intimately familiar with it.
Yeah, I think it's still really the story of my heart. And I've read it a lot of times now. But what actually really helps is listening to the audiobook, which is also out today, read by David Dawson. He is brilliant at reading it. And I love listening to it because he just brings it to life in a way that when I read it, it's in my voice, but he does all the different voices and it's wonderful.
Isn't that fun to hear someone else kind of bring what you do to life? And I've narrated some things, and the best compliment you can get is like, well, you said exactly what I was thinking, but in a unique way. And I'm like, that's exactly what you're going for.
Yeah, exactly. And some of the characters, he's given them certain accents, and I heard it, I thought, that's perfect. I can imagine this character even more. It's a wonderful creative experience.
Well, the highly anticipated debut novel, Scandor and the Unicorn Thief, is now available where books are sold. The author is my guest, A.F. Stedman, and thank you very much for joining me today, and congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And welcome back to the Big Wake Up Call. I'm Ryan Gatenby, and time for my next guest was the founder of one of the most popular and rewarded finance blogs called Mixed Up Money. She is the author of a brand new book called Financial First Aid, Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. And we're going to visit with Alyssa Davies. And Alyssa, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
How are you? How are things going where you are?
Everything's going great. Groceries are still expensive, but I'm able to afford my latte, and that's all that really matters to me.
I think this is the first time a lot of people really got a sense of how real inflation is and how it's happening, because it always seemed like such an abstract concept. Oh, inflation's up 2%, but I think a lot of people going to the grocery store and especially pumping gas are realizing, oh, this is real. This is really hitting us significantly.
Absolutely. It's one of those moments when you realize how expensive life can be if you aren't prepared, if you don't have that financial security that so many of us crave.
So tell us a little bit about the book, Financial First Aid, and was a lot of this, did the inspiration come from a lot of the mixed up money topics you were writing about?
Definitely. A lot of it has come with a lot of the money mistakes or financial errors I've made throughout my life. And also, I have high-functioning anxiety, so any way that I can take back control of areas in my life is key for me. And so that's where financial emergency funds and creating backup plans has given me back the power and made me feel more financially free.
All right. I relate to you with a high-functioning anxiety, and that's mainly the reason I'm doing radio instead of trying for TV, because it's a little bit more comfortable, but that's interesting that you can admit you're coming from a place of mistakes. And I feel like we see so many so-called financial experts are like, well, here I am and I'm on top and here's how I did it and I'm perfect and you can be perfect too.
I totally agree. I think that a lot of the financial advice that we're used to seeing is fear-based, shame-based,
yes,
and rooted in guilt that we grew up. Yes, feeling so insecure about money and lacking that confidence. And when you approach things from a different place, or when you find someone you can resonate with as far as financial knowledge goes, it changes the game.
Yeah, what is the benefit of that, and what is the motivator using, as you meant, guilt-based and shame-based? And I'm thinking, I still hear it today, commercials that we run and make you feel bad. Well, if you have more than $5,000 in credit card debt, call this. And it's trying to help people, but you can tell just, I don't know, the phrasing or the tone of voice, it feels a little judgy.
Absolutely. And I think that that's what makes us disassociate or reject finance completely, in the sense that we avoid thinking about it, avoid talking about it, and it dominates our thoughts. And so it creates these really unhealthy money boundaries where we end up saving or hoarding money because we fear that we're never going to have enough. And it also puts us in a place where we feel like we cannot succeed. We won't be able to get out of the position we're in because this is just life now. And so by shifting the narrative and making it more comfortable and safe to talk about, it really changes the way we use our money.
And it's hard to know sometimes where to start to begin to dig out of it. Like, people get themselves in debt and it's the balance. Like, well, I want to pay off debt, but I also need to save money because we want to buy, you know, a house in the next year or so. So balancing paying off debt and saving money, it seems like nearly impossible sometimes. You feel like you're so up against it.
Something that can eat us alive if we don't take control of it. But something else too is, a lot of us are really upset or feel frustrated when we cannot hit all of those traditional milestones that were set forth for us. So if you feel like you need to get married, you need to have kids, you need to buy a house, all of those things require security and financial stability. And if you have debt, it becomes really difficult to actually gain traction and achieve those things. So one thing that's really important is, when you're paying off debt, is to also provide yourself with the ability to save a small buffer or an emergency fund, so that if something does happen that could potentially derail your progress, you have a backup plan and you can continue to make that progress on debt repayment.
It's interesting you're talking about the traditional path you're supposed to follow, because we did, you know, buy a house last year for you know, the first time in my life, and I'm 50 years old. And I mentioned that on Twitter, and I got a couple responses, and one was, okay, boomer. I'm like, I'm Gen X. Don't call me boomer. We had a much more difficult path than the boomers.
Yes, totally. It's really interesting because millennials and Gen X both have a really difficult time building wealth, because we've been put through all of these significant world happenings like the pandemic that have completely shifted our ability to accumulate wealth and to build wealth. So I love that you waited until you were ready to buy a home at 50. If that's how long it takes, that's how long it takes. It's whatever works so that you can continue to live the lifestyle that makes sense for you.
We hear so often, and I'm getting tired of the term, like when I was growing up, it's like, oh, I got a second job and now it's a side hustle. But it feels like if you really need to, if you can, have multiple streams of income, if one of those is a side hustle. I hear about passive income. How do you feel about having a multiple streams of income, and how do you make that possible?
I love multiple streams of income. I love it because they provide you with protection in moments of emergency. And so if you suffer an unexpected job loss tomorrow, you know that you have a backup plan or a place to reach for more income if you need it. And so I personally have 9 streams of income, but I started with 1, just like most of us. And so it takes time to build streams of income, but I think a lot of us have more than we realize. We have our full-time job, potentially. You might already have a part-time job. You probably have a high-yield savings account, which provides you with some interest back. And if you're investing in your future and in a 401k, then right there you have dividends and you have capital gains, and you're giving yourself the ability to earn income passively.
Now, I never thought about it that way, but savings and, yeah, building equity in your home, things like that is a separate stream of income. When you're talking about multiple streams, I'm thinking like, oh, I've got to have a blog and a podcast and something else and monetize all of those. And while that's great, yeah, I didn't think about some of the things you mentioned. That's interesting that we might have some multiple streams without realizing it. And how am I not realizing I'm making money?
Exactly. I think that we are really ingrained in that hustle culture that you keep mentioning, of like, you have to keep working harder. And if you aren't making enough money, if you don't feel secure, then you're not working hard enough. And that's not necessarily the reality. A lot of us don't have that extra time to allocate towards an additional job. So finding those other more accessible options is key.
And well, and as we talked about it earlier, the guilt and the shame, you're meant to think sometimes like, oh, I can't make ends meet. I'm doing the best I can, but you're not doing it. You're looked down upon. You feel like you're a failure. And so many judgments are made when people really need, you know, they need information, they need education. And I don't know about you, but I was not told anything about, you know, saving money and building a financial profile in school.
Absolutely. I had to learn the hard way, and yeah. I'm sharing this knowledge now so that other people don't have to learn the hard way. You can learn from my mistakes and maybe get ahead. And then when you're my age, hopefully it's less overwhelming and hopefully you have better foothold on your financial future.
Any quick tip for our listeners? And I know a lot of people have probably been overworked during the pandemic, working from home, working more hours. What's the first step to take to kind of begin to negotiate for a higher salary?
One thing you want to do is your research. A lot of us will go into any sort of negotiation not having the confidence that we need to ask for what we deserve. And so when you know what you're worth and what your position is valued at, it becomes a lot easier to ask for what you want. So that's one thing. And another thing is I like to tell people that a great thing to do is actually to pretend you're advocating for your best friend or a family member. Because that way you might feel a lot more confidence and a lot more urgency to ask for what you want. Because the worst thing that they can say is no.
That's great to try to do that, because, and that just proves that you don't necessarily see yourself how others see you. So putting yourself in the place of describing your friend, that's a great tactic. I like that.
Definitely.
And the new book, it's called Financial First Aid, Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. It is now available where books are sold. The author is my guest, Alyssa Davies. And thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.